David Bowie, to this day, 5 years after his passing and 59 after the beginning of his career, remains one of the most influential artists of all time. Now, when I say artist, I really mean it. I think that it's essential when discussing Bowie to do so in recognition of what he truly was, not just a musician, but so much more than that. David was an actor, an innovator, and a true original. He was well-read and extremely intelligent. Sometimes he was even a mime. David Bowie is far from just a musician. He is a true performer in every sense of the word. From Lady Gaga to Marilyn Manson, countless artists have followed in his footsteps, not only taking influences from his music itself, but from the way that he functioned as a rock star. After all, during the height of his career, David wasn't really David at all. He was Major Tom, a lonely astronaut stranded in space. He was Ziggy Stardust, an omnisexual alien rock star. He was Aladdin Sane, the Thin White Duke, and Halloween Jack. And today, he is an icon, a performance art pioneer. This week, we're talking the power of persona, how David Bowie made a career out of being someone else. Good afternoon, Golden Hawks, and thank you for tuning in to Radio Wyoming. My name is Megan, and you are listening to The Downbeat, a show where I get into the nitty-gritty, the deep cuts, and hot topics of rock and roll throughout the decades. This week, we start our journey in 1950s London, where David Robert Jones grew up. Even as a child, David Bowie was extremely artistic. In interviews, he described himself as arty, and at school, he participated in choir and practiced various instruments, including the recorder. His early influences came from American records that his father would bring home for him. These included the likes of Fats Domino, Elvis Presley, and Little Richard. He was also exposed to a great deal of jazz music early on in his life, thanks to his older brother. Throughout high school, he started various bands with friends, and his passion for music was quite clear. But what was likely most influential on Bowie and his success from his childhood was not of musical origin at all. You see, David's family had a history of severe mental health issues, including schizophrenia and depression. In his youth, David always felt isolated due to a lacking support system and deemed himself an outcast. This morbid upbringing is likely what spurred his passion for individuality as an artist. It is this drive that separated him from other musicians of the time and catapulted him into the 59-year career that we all know today. But before we get into that career, I don't think that a David Bowie origin story would be complete without the story of his signature eyes. Well, I guess I should say. After getting into a fight with a schoolmate, one strong slug to the face landed him in the hospital for 4 months. The punch hit him right in the eye, landing him with a permanently dilated pupil. This is why, in most pictures of him, it appears that he has 2 different colored eyes. Luckily for David, this only added to his individual look and has become one of his most iconic features. But back to the storyline. After his days in school, David became dedicated to starting a career in the arts. And when I say dedicated, I mean dedicated. He tried to make music with various groups under various names. All of his records at the time were labeling their lead vocalists as either Tom Jones or Davy Jones, David not taking the stage name Bowie until 1966 to avoid confusion surrounding the member of the Monkees, who was also called Tom Jones. The bands that he played with include, but are not limited to, the Conrads, David Jones and the King Bees, the Manish Boys, and the Lower Third. Not much came of this but a few singles and passing the hands of various record labels. Aside from music, David also tried to get exposure in other various artistic modes, starring in commercials and practicing miming. Aside from his recorded music work, he also hosted a folk night at a local pub. It wasn't until 1966 that he released his first record under the name of David Bowie, a single called Can't Help Thinking About Me. The twangy pop single didn't really make any waves, failing to chart in the US or the UK, and the group that Bowie recorded with, the Lower Third, broke up soon after. Obviously, the song is far from a masterpiece, but I think what it really lacks is any sense of Bowie flair or individuality. Sure, you can hear that signature voice, but there's no difference between the single and most Beatles-sounding songs that were on the radio in the UK at the time. Have a listen, and hopefully you'll see what I mean. I can't help thinking about me. I can't help thinking about me. after the release of this single, in 1967, Bowie released another song. Now, this one definitely doesn't disappoint in terms of separating itself from pop music of the time. In a bizarre duet with himself, one track being Bowie's raw vocals and another a sped-up, high-pitched recording, Bowie converses throughout the song with, well, a gnome. The song is called The Laughing Gnome and was equally as unsuccessful as Can't Help Thinking About Me. In terms of progression for Bowie and his music, it's a step in the right direction, given that it is simply bizarre. And after all, most things that we've come to appreciate about David Bowie are derived from the fact that he is just that, a little bit bizarre. Although this song is admittedly not on my Bowie favorites playlist, it is an important one nonetheless. Now, just because I know you're dying to hear what the hell I'm talking about, here's a snippet from The Laughing Gnome.
I'm the laughing gnome, you can't catch me, said the laughing.
In the same year as this song's release, David Bowie also put out a self-titled album with Duram Records. Obviously, it's not uncommon for artists to put out self-titled records, especially as a first release. What I think is important to note in this particular context is that this is Bowie's first and only album release that predates the launch of his star status career. He was least popular when he was simply David Bowie. On the album itself, the overall sound is very whimsical and quirky, I guess is the best way to put it. It's starkly different from most of his later releases, and for that reason, many people who enjoy the glam rock sensibility of Ziggy Stardust don't have much of a taste for this album. In terms of lyricism and vocal performance, you can definitely see Bowie's theatrical influences beginning to shine through here, the tangy instrumentation often accompanied by some sort of storytelling vocal. Again, this is important as it marks Bowie's progression towards his signature style, telling stories of fictional identities through elaborate songs and stage shows. The instrumentation on the album is a bit of an odd mishmash, from the tuba to the sitar. Thematically, the album is also an odd combo from drug use to cannibalism to abortion. Overall, the album was met with a lackluster response and did not chart, but the record is an early indicator of Bowie's songwriting abilities and knack for breaking the mold. It wasn't until 1969 that David Bowie finally broke into the business. The song was Space Oddity, and the response was phenomenal. The single was released 5 days before the Apollo 11 moon landing and followed the story of Bowie's very first persona, Major Tom. Major Tom was an astronaut launched into space who became abandoned in his ship. The story of the lost astronaut floating alone in the vast nothingness of space is often connected to Bowie's early life. As I said earlier, he always considered himself an outsider as a child. Even at home, he felt isolated, as many of his family members struggled with mental disorders, as I said. He always felt like he was on the outside looking in, unable to make his way back to reality. Many people sympathize with Major Tom's story, relating their own experiences to that of the lost spaceman, making him Bowie's most relatable character. The song itself is obviously a masterpiece, given it's one of the most popular rock songs to date. Bowie's named Stanley Kubrick's film 2001 A Space Odyssey as an influence for the tune. Apparently, he went to the theater stoned out of his mind, and the film freaked him out a bit. Interestingly enough, that freaky was the direction Bowie decided to take in revamping his musical career. The mixing of the song adds to the futuristic appeal. This fascination with space exploration undoubtedly contributed to the song's success, with its release so close to the moon landing. Unusually for the time, the song was mixed in both mono and stereo formats, but it's the stereo version that highlights the otherworldly sound of the track. The song's style can be described as psychedelic rock, but the acoustic quality separates it from much of the hard-rocking hits of Jimi Hendrix or Cream. The song's structure, framed as a narrative story, is again important for establishing Bowie's style and tendency to stray from simply singing songs. Space Oddity is a journey in itself, and listening to it can be an immersive experience. If you don't want to take my word for it, have a listen for yourself.
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade.
And just like that, Bowie was introduced to the world through the role of Major Tom. The character was short-lived in comparison to its successors, but is later mentioned in 1979's Scary Monsters and Super Creeps album, but I'll get to that later. After the success of Space Oddity, Bowie quickly put out another self-titled album. The obvious confusion surrounding this and the previous David Bowie album led to re-release of the record under several names. I believe if you try to look it up on Spotify right now, it is simply called David Bowie, aka Space Oddity. The 9-track record is definitely more experimental than that of the first. Song durations range from 3 to 9 minutes, as opposed to the standard 3-minute format of the previous release. The overall sound is pretty consistent with that of the Space Oddity single, and standouts for me include A Letter to Hermione and Memory of a Free Festival. Drop of all the ecstasy that swept that afternoon. In 1970, David took on his next project, The Man Who Sold the World. This album has a much harder rocking sound than that of his early work and shows promise for future guitar-led tracks. If you listened to the show last week, the album name might be ringing a bell for you. That's because the title track was covered by Nirvana in their MTV Unplugged in New York session. Their version is undoubtedly more popular, given that the release of the album was not extremely successful for Bowie. Sandwiched between two of his more popular works, Space Oddity and Hunky Dory, this Bowie Does Rock album often gets lost in the mix. However, I think it is definitely worth a listen. The title track and the introductory track, The Width of a Circle, are a step in the direction of the rise and fall, with plenty of bluesy guitar to go around. But before he made the culture-shocking 1972 album, The Rise and Fall, Bowie took 1971 to slow things down a bit. Taking time off from performing, Bowie wrote a collection of piano-based songs that leaned more towards punk than they did guitar-driven rock and roll or glam rock. What resulted was, in my opinion, one of his best works. The album was Hunky Dory. Turn and face the strange changes. This album definitely shows the arty side of David Bowie, with many literary, cultural, and philosophical references sprinkled throughout the lyrics. He references many cultural icons of the time directly in songs including Bob Dylan and Andy Warhol. At the time, both were considered cultural changemakers in their own right, with Dylan being a famed leader of the folk movement and Warhol a prophet of New York City's punk underground. With Hunky Dory, it becomes clear that David Bowie was invested in art and culture in every sense of the term, and his intelligence shines through along with his various philosophical references. It is for this reason, and the numerous fantastic songs on the record, that it has become known as the album When Bowie Became Bowie. This may be the very reason that for the last time in a while, David Bowie did not take on a persona for the album. It is an excellent representation of Bowie in a pure form. Although not all of the songs are written from his own perspective, the stripped-down and piano-driven quality of the album gives the listener the sense that there is no grand scheme behind this album. There's no grand production or glittering costumes to match it. It's simply David Bowie making great, intelligent art. The opening track, Changes, is likely one of the most popular from the record. The lyrics of the song are extremely fitting for this episode, as David sings about artistic reinvention as a rock star, a skill that, as we all know now, he was a master of. Track 2, Oh You Pretty Things, is one of my favorites of his entire catalog. Although the musicality of the song is seemingly upbeat, topics in the lyrics cover the occult and teachings of a German philosopher whose name I cannot pronounce, but will put in the description. This was one of the first Bowie songs to startle close-minded audiences at the time, but by the mid-70s, it wasn't unusual for interviewers to ask Bowie about his worship practices, and if any of them involved dark magic. The bottom line is, Bowie was always good at ruffling feathers with right-minded people, especially those of 1970s Britain. This song, and the album altogether, marks the first instance of this. But regardless of whether you like the lyrical content or not, you can't deny it's so damn catchy. Oh, you pretty things. Don't you know you're dropping your mind? Although these first two tracks are phenomenal, the star of the album is clearly the theatrical ballad, Life on Mars. The song is praised as one of Bowie's finest works, many publications ranking it one of the best rock songs of all time. Interestingly enough, it was written slightly out of spite due to an interaction Bowie had with none other than Frank Sinatra. Well, I use the term interaction loosely here. Basically, what happened was Bowie originally wrote a version of the song that was rejected by another artist. Frank Zappa then took the song and reworked it, his version being recorded and released as Frank Sinatra's My Way. Being understandably a bit niffed at this, David recorded the song as Life on Mars for Hunky Dory, producing one of his greatest works. The song itself is beautifully structured. The way that Bowie's vocal builds throughout the song is, to me, what makes it so hard-hitting by the end. I won't lie when I tell you that this song has brought me to tears on several occasions. The lyrics speak of a girl who goes to the movies to escape reality. Again, extremely relatable content to the average arty listener that Bowie no doubt attracted with this record. The title itself references the race between America and the Soviets to get to Mars, despite many people thinking that it references space themes, like that of Space Oddity and The Rise and Fall. The song is now iconic, with covers popping up everywhere, from a Barbra Streisand rendition to an episode of American Horror Story. Again, although the song's story follows a mousy-haired girl who attends cinema, I think that the song is a great representation of Bowie being Bowie. I mean, what's more David Bowie than writing a musical masterpiece, just despite one of the biggest faces in music history? Aside from the aforementioned three tracks, Hunky Dory is chock full of other amazing songs, including Queen Bitch and Quicksand. And if any of you are film fans out there, I remember noticing Queen Bitch in the ending scene of The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. So if you're a Wes Anderson fan and haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. Sorry for that random tidbit. I had to share. Anyways, let's get back to Bowie. After the release of Hunky Dory, or rather, even during the release of it, Bowie was beginning to craft his most renowned work of all time. The thing was, it wasn't just the music that he was feverishly working on, it was the entire next chapter of his career. This is where we start to see Bowie become the full-blown rock star we know today by being, well, not Bowie at all. His new persona was Ziggy Stardust, an omnisexual alien rock star sent to Earth with a message for humans. His band were the Spiders from Mars, and together they crafted a glam rock album that was so beloved it remained on the album charts for 2 whole years. Now, before we get into the album itself, the songs, influences, the music, I want to talk a little bit about the cultural significance of what this album really was. Up until this point in time, musical performers played their songs on stage in a very organic manner. Hitmakers of the time, the Zeppelins and the Stones, with their sold-out venues and their millions of screaming fans, took the stage as themselves. They played their songs, and they left. When you went to see a Zeppelin show, you got Robert Plant in some tight pants and a woman's top. And when you went to see the Rolling Stones, you got Mick Jagger frolicking across the stage. It's not to say that these artists lacked flair or individual style, but the act of performing on stage was little to do with the theatricality in an acting sense. They performed as their true selves. Up until this point, rock artists did not reinvent themselves as their music style changed. Bowie changed this. Ziggy Stardust was more than a character on an album cover. He was more than a name that David Bowie donned. Bowie threw himself into the character, fully becoming this otherworldly rock star. In interviews, backstage, and wherever else you might speak to him, fans did not meet David Bowie. They met Ziggy Stardust. His physical appearance changed drastically as well, putting on layers of face makeup, costumes, platform shoes, and an orange mullet. This extremely androgynous look was nothing that anyone had ever done before in front of such a large mainstream audience. To the majority of British publications and journalists, it was simply outrageous. To his fans, it was a creative awakening. Ziggy was a symbol for individuality, a prophet for the weird and downtrodden. This is why David Bowie is considered one of rock's greatest innovators. He took his passion for theater and acting and applied it to rock stardom. Compared to the acts of the time, he was doing something no one else did. In his own words, Bowie said he is a collector of personalities. He can listen to others speak and pick up their accents in 2 sentences. When he began to draw attention in the industry, he wanted to defy the expectations of what a rock and roll performer should be. So, he drew on this talent. He wanted to be put in a category that would leave him room to work in, so he developed the archetype of the Messiah rock star. His influences for the character and his performances that matched it included Japanese kabuki theater, mime technique, fringe New York music, such as that of the Velvet Underground, and an overall British view of American street energy. What resulted was an elaborate theater piece, where both on and off stage, the character of Ziggy was always present. David said that the story of Ziggy was developed so far beyond what he created, as the fans connected so much with him. Half of the stories of the character were created by fans, and that is what was so captivating about all of this. Bowie managed to further the experience of rock shows from a live music experience to that of a grander, more interactive scale. Unfortunately, this all became too much of a good thing at one point, Bowie citing that he couldn't tell the difference between himself and Ziggy by the end of it. But the upside was a cultural shakeup and a cult classic album that is one of the best ever produced in rock music.
I'm an alligator. I'm a mama, papa coming for you.
Now, let's talk about the album itself. The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and Spiders from Mars. Thematically, The Rise and Fall is the peak of Bowie's space obsession. Similar ideas were touched upon in Space Oddity, but this album is his supernova of intergalactic exploration. I'm so sorry that line was, like, disgustingly cheesy, but I didn't know how else to put it. Anyways, in terms of style, it's Bowie's true glam rock era. The instrumentation ranges from killer guitar riffs to smooth saxophone jams. The inspiration behind the album's musicality is likely derived from popular glam rock acts of the time in the UK. Bowie himself cited Mark Bolan and T-Rex, both as inspirations for the album. But the best part of the album, and likely why it was so well received by fans both past and present, is because of the storytelling element that Bowie utilizes. The Beatles may have invented the concept album, but David Bowie mastered it. From start to finish, the record takes you on a mission with Ziggy to save the world with rock and roll. This journey begins on track one with 5 Years, a song outlining the reactions of the public to the news. The world will end in 5 years. With each song, the story of Ziggy progresses. Soul Love, the album's beautiful second track, tells of Ziggy's struggle with understanding love. On Earth, love is such an important and coveted concept. Being alone on Earth, all he can do is romanticize this love, but can never have it for himself. Have a listen.
Inspirations have I none, just a touch of flaming dove. All I have...
Moon Age Daydream is the third track of the album and is chock full of social commentary. Based on my research, I don't think that there's one sole interpretation of the song that fans can agree upon. But one lyric, however, "The Church of Man Love is such a holy place to be," definitely hints at humanity's tendency to praise their own knowledge above all else, straying from other forms of faith-based worship. Building on this idea, themes of dehumanization and a world stripped of any real intention or heart seems to be present. Starman, likely one of his best-known songs of all time, furthers the idea of encouraging youth to fully enjoy their lives. The so-called Starman is a symbol of open-mindedness and youth sensibility. Parents and older individuals can't see the Starman because they are set in their ways. They refuse to open their minds to the possibilities beyond the culture and the religion and the social structures that they have built for themselves. Ziggy encourages the children to stray from this.
Let the children lose it. Let the children use it. Let all the children do get
it. It Ain't Easy, track number 5 on the record, is simply an expression by Ziggy about the difficulty of his mission. It seemed simple from above, but once he gets down in the dirt, many more problems spring up and complicate his end goal. This end goal being, if you've forgotten, to save the world with his sparkly space eyeshadow and wicked hair. And of course, his rock and roll music. Tracks Lady Ziggy Stardust and Starr both outline the glitz, glam, and inspiration behind becoming a rock star. From a Ziggy perspective, this makes perfect sense, given that, well, that's kind of his whole deal. It is said that the Lady Stardust mentioned in the song is supposedly Mark Bolan of T-Rex. In my opinion, he could very likely have been the inspiration behind the song, which subsequently fits the rock star theme of the album. Thus, the song itself has duality in terms of applicable meaning. Lady Stardust is Mark Bolan, Lady Stardust is Ziggy. Lady Stardust is the glam rocker who dares to dress different, get on stage, and put on a show. In terms of progression in Ziggy's story, we are at a bit of a hold-up up until Hang On To Yourself, a tune that details the excitement and rush of fame, but warns that this turbulence can often lead to one losing themselves in the spotlight. It is on the title track, Ziggy Stardust, that everything starts crashing down. After all, we've been hearing about the rise of Ziggy, and now he must fall. The song tells the story of how the Spiders from Mars were a band before Ziggy, but were catapulted into fame when he joined the band. They became jealous of him and had to break his hands. This is all the more heartbreaking because of the opening line, "Ziggy played guitar." By breaking his hands, they took away his rock and roll powers. Now, their jealousy and betrayal, are you getting the Messiah references yet, become his downfall. Ziggy kills himself and the world loses their savior. The brilliance of the lyricism for this song is highlighted in the first and last lines of the song being the exact same. In the beginning, it is established Ziggy played guitar. That was his thing. He was first and foremost a musician. By the end, however, there's a gloomy yet optimistic undertone. Ziggy is dead, but we still have the music he left behind. Ziggy played guitar.
Ziggy played guitar.
The second last track on the album seems somewhat out of place in terms of the Ziggy plotline. The main character of the story seems to be in a relationship with a liberated woman, since Suffragette is referencing a woman's right to vote. I think that in this instance, Suffragette City refers to the girlfriend of the narrator who had a very tight hold on him, but he doesn't care because she puts out easily, so he goes along with it. My interpretation could be a little twisted, but nonetheless, the song itself is extremely catchy, and a brief sigh of relief between the two kind of death-heavy tracks it separates. Speaking of which, let's now turn our attention to the final song on the album, and one of my personal favorites, Rock and Roll Suicide. The final song on the album is extremely emotional and a phenomenal way to finish such a theatrical musical journey. Many people have their own interpretations of the song, and I think that, in itself, is the beauty of it. As I discussed before, Ziggy and his story was more so carried out by the fans than it was by Bowie himself. They connected with Ziggy and felt that they knew him. The song is a clear implication as to why this was the case. Ziggy is dead. He gave his life for the revolution of rock and roll. This is the rock and roll suicide in question. But the final few lyrics, Ziggy screaming, "You are not alone," makes a genuine connection with the listener. Because Ziggy appealed to the outsiders of society, similar to those who connected with Major Tom of Space Oddity, his final words of encouragement resonate with them. Whenever tough times arise, Ziggy, and the music that he left behind, will be there for them. All they need to do is look to the Starman. So, when Ziggy died on the album, what happened to the Ziggy performing on stage every night? After touring from February of 1972 to July 3rd of 1973, Ziggy announced to the sold-out London venue that he would be retiring, saying, "Of all the shows on this tour, this particular show will remain with us the longest, because not only is it the last show of the tour, it is the last show we'll ever do." Of course, by saying this, it meant Ziggy would never play a show again, not Bowie himself. However, fans didn't know this, many of them chasing down his car as he left the venue. Now, at this point in 1973, the tour had spanned over three David Bowie album releases. It began during the height of Hunky Dory, through the Rise and Fall era, and ended after the release of his next album, Aladdin Sane. Speaking of which, who is Aladdin Sane?
We'll love Aladdin Sane.
Admittedly Bowie's most iconic-looking alter ego, Aladdin didn't have much substance in comparison to other personas that he donned. The lightning bolt, that one across his face on the album art, is actually often associated with Ziggy Stardust. Although this is technically wrong, it is somewhat accurate in the sense that Aladdin Sane was simply the Americanized version of Ziggy. But let's get back to that lightning bolt. The now iconic red and blue face paint has a much deeper meaning than face value. The album Aladdin Sane came out at a time when Bowie was struggling with the rock star lifestyle. He loved performing and singing his songs for his fans, but the backstage hustle and bustle became a little bit too much for him. He was fractured. One side of him loved what he did, and the other part of him wanted to leave it all behind. According to Bowie himself, Aladdin Sane was less cut and dry than Ziggy was, calling him ephemeral. He said, "I think he encompasses situations as well as just being a personality. These situations, one can assume, have to do with the dark side of fame that Bowie was struggling with at the time while touring in America." I think that the real difference between the two characters is most notable in the style of music made in each of the periods. Ziggy was peak glam rock. Aladdin was a bit of a darker character and appealed more to middle American music fans who had a developed taste for hard rocking hits from Led Zeppelin and other stadium rockers of the time. The instrumentation of the album is clearly heavier, with a bit of a grunge-like sound. Take the beginning of the first track, Watch That Man, for example. The album's second and title track is an excellent precursor of Bowie's experimental phase. The unsettling piano solo by avant-garde pianist Mike Garson is the standout of the song. The track clearly establishes Bowie's retirement of Ziggy Stardust, taking up the mantle of this new, slightly twisted and uneasy version of the alien rock star. Aladdin Sane is born. I won't get into too much detail with each track on this record, simply because I find its significance to be lesser than, in terms of the rise and fall. That's not to say that this Bowie era was anything but fantastic. The album is simply just not as well known as The Rise and Fall, and thus the discourse surrounding it is reflectively minimal. However, I do want to emphasize that Bowie wasn't lying when he said Aladdin Sane was Ziggy Goes to America. Tracks such as the famed Gene Genie and Watch That Man are clearly influenced by music that was most popular in America at the time. Although they are a British band, the Rolling Stones were one of America's prized performers at the time, and the Stones sound is clearly evident in much of the album. Bowie was clearly trying to appeal to American audiences. Gene Genie lives on his back. I think what's most important to recognize about Aladdin Sane was that it was the first time Bowie managed to switch personas, quite successfully I might add, in a way that organically matched his switch in music style. Again, this is something that hadn't been done before, at least not to this extreme. Bowie was beginning to establish himself as a musical chameleon, providing himself with the space to grow and change whenever he saw fit. But apparently after the Aladdin Sane era, Bowie saw it fit to stay Bowie for a while. Now that he put out three excellent albums in the span of 3 years, his next release was understandably underwhelming. Pinups was a series of covers that, to be completely honest with you, I have never listened to in my life. And I think that my lacking interest in the album is shared amongst most Bowie fans. My sister's a pretty dedicated fan who's read up on much of his life and work, and even she doesn't have a single download from this album in her library. Now, I'm not saying that it's bad. All I'm saying is it's David Bowie we're talking about here. There's so much more fantastic material we could spend our time on, so let's just skip Pinups for now. So that being said, let's fast forward to 1974 with the release of Diamond Dogs and the birth of Bowie's accompanying personality, Halloween Jack. Rebel, rebel, apple dango. Hot tramp, I love you so. Described as a real cool cat from Hunger City, Halloween Jack is the persona that Bowie donned during his Diamond Dogs era. Pictured on the album art as a half-man, half-dog, Halloween Jack is an eye-patch-wearing soul man with the same flaming hair as that of Ziggy Stardust and Aladdin Sane. Diamond Dogs was a post-apocalyptic concept album, which again showcased Bowie's glam rock style that was so well received with the rise and fall. The difference was, however, Diamond Dogs had a bit of a soul-like sound to it. I myself hadn't listened to the album all the way through until it came down to researching this episode. The album itself is good, but I do find that I'm beginning to get a little bit bored with the whole glam rock sound. Of course, Rebel Rebel is a Bowie classic, but none of the other tracks stand out to me as other non-singles have on the past Bowie albums I've been listening to. So let's move on to Bowie's ninth album, Young Americans. As Bowie described it, Young Americans is plastic soul. What does that mean exactly? Well, basically the entire album is an imitation of soul music sung by David Bowie. In this sense, there's no character associated with the album aside from David Bowie that plays historically black music. I think that this is made most clear in the title track. Young Americans is undoubtedly a soul song. The instrumentation makes this quite clear, as does the backing vocals. One interesting thing to note about the song is the Beatles reference in the chorus line, "I heard the news today, oh boy," which is a line from the Beatles song A Day in My Life. Interestingly enough, as the other notable song on the album, Fame, was co-written by Beatle John Lennon. This song is, in a way, a direct callback thematically to albums of Bowie past. Fame can be hard, blah blah blah. We get the point by now. Overall, Young Americans is fantastic for the two songs that I've named, but aside from this, it doesn't really do much in terms of Bowie's progression as a performer. Then, we get Station to Station. Station to Station was Bowie's next release in 1976. Often called the Coke era, this was a time when Bowie was struggling severely with substance abuse. It was at this point that he took up his perhaps most captivating character, aside from Ziggy, the Thin White Duke. At this point in his career, Bowie was living in Los Angeles. He felt quite isolated there, and supposedly lived off of milk, peppers, and cocaine alone. It was at this very low point in his life that he made Station to Station, an experimental, clearly colder album in contrast to that of the glimmering quality of his glam rock offerings. Golden Years and Station to Station are the stars of the small six-track album, but if you find the time, I recommend having a full listen. It's a refreshing change of pace. It becomes evident that this new persona is much colder than those of Bowie's past, as many of the lyrics are either emotional and delivered in a cold tone, or singing of a loss of ability to emote. Now when I say this, I'm talking about the title track, more specifically, but much of the album's sound is equally as cold and mechanical. With this persona, the Thin White Duke, Bowie went beyond a record and a stage show, often noted as his darkest character. Criticism surrounded the Thin White Duke, and for good reason. Given his struggle with cocaine addiction at the time, the Thin White Duke looks exactly as one might expect. His signature cheekbones are particularly prominent, and instead of his usually shaggy haircut, he has his hair slicked back with a fiery ombre coloring. In his time as the Duke, Bowie's overall demeanor switched. In interviews, he expressed his support of fascism. He called Hitler a rock star, and the way that he could command a crowd, I'd like to point that out, and that every society needed a little bit of right-winged fascism to keep them in line. Overall, understandably, this was a controversial character for Bowie, and it led many fans to beg the question, where is the line between Bowie and the Duke? He even took the persona with him to the big screen, starring in The Man Who Fell to Earth as alien Thomas Newton. Newton and the Thin White Duke share quite a few similarities in physical appearance and their overall cold demeanor. Again, that cold demeanor that is reflected in his music of the time. To put it shortly, the Duke was likely Bowie's most intense character. And although we got some terrific art out of it, it was likely Bowie's darkest era, simply as a person. Let's take a pause for a second to digest everything we've just gone over. Over the span of 7 years, David Bowie portrayed five personas apart from his own and put out nine studio albums. He went from performing in commercials and as a mime to performing for thousands of adoring fans every single night. He was Major Tom, an outcast. He was Ziggy, an androgynous alien messiah. He was Aladdin Sane, a Ziggy drenched in Americana. He was the Thin White Duke, a version of himself that he later admitted he barely remembers because his struggles with cocaine addiction. And now, we're left with a Bowie that is clearly in need of a change. So, what did Bowie do next? Well, I guess you're gonna have to tune in next week to find out. This leaves you on a bit of a cliffhanger. I apologize. As I was doing the research for this episode, I just realized Bowie's career is so long. There's no way that I could fit it into one episode. So next episode, I'll be finishing up all of the different stages of Bowie, and I might even get into a conversation with a friend who is a big fan and a fellow Laurier student. That being said, thank you so much to those of you who have made it this far. I really appreciate all of the support that I received on the first episode last week. I wasn't really expecting it. So if you're a returning listener, just know that I really do truly appreciate you. It means so much. And as I said last time, if you ever want to talk music, send me a DM over Instagram. I'm super open to talk. My user is Megan Folsom, MEGANFULSOM. And I think that about does it. So thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Downbeat, and I will hopefully see you next week. Bye.